Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Everybody breathing a sigh of relief in there in the booth because there's not 20 students hovering over them. But we had a good time with the students from St. Joseph Academy. But now it's all open forum via the phone. So you're welcome to call 888-318-7884 if you've got a question for Jimmy. When Jimmy's here, pretty much any question is okey-doke, and anyone is welcome to call. I know Jimmy has lots and lots of fans from his own show, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and you want to talk to Jimmy? This is a great opportunity to do it. 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. Jimmy, thank you for being back with us for another hour.
My pleasure, Cyril Kellett, host of Catholic Answers Live.
I do appreciate the formality of your responses. I do appreciate that.
Sometimes formality is a sign of respect. Yes. I remember when I was married, my wife passed on a number of years ago, but when I was married, I remember taking my wife to a doctor's office, and instead of referring to her as Renee, they would refer to her as Mrs. Akin, which she really appreciated. She took it as a sign of respect and not the just informality of assuming it's okay to use your first name. Right. With someone without even asking.
Yeah.
It's really culturally varies, but being formal can be a sign of respect.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it can sometimes just be silly, Cyril Kellett, just so you know.
I know, but I feel somewhat at a disadvantage because when you call me Cyril Kellett, and apologies for this, but then I want to respond James Akin, but that is not your name, James.
That is
Akin.
Not my name. You're already using the full version except for my middle name, which will remain undisclosed.
All right. If you have a question for Jimmy Elmer Akin, you are welcome to call.
Elmer is not my middle name.
I was looking just to see. The number is 888-318-7884. Already lots of folks on the line. So we'll go to David in Illinois, watching on Catholic.com, our website. David, glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I had a question. I understand the reasoning behind holy days and how they are a good pious practice, but I don't know how to square up days of holy obligation with scripture passages such as like Romans 14, where Paul is talking about how not to force things upon one another and things of that nature. And so I, as a Protestant, looking into the church, I wanted that explained to me.
Okay, so Romans 14 is a chapter where Paul is talking about relations within the church between different kinds of people, and this kind of grows out of his discussion at the beginning of Romans of Jewish and Gentile relations in the church. Do you need to be a Jew in order to be a Christian and be saved? And really, that theme overarches the entire book of Romans. And typically in Paul's letters, he deals with the doctrinal matters up front. And then in the latter part of a letter, he deals with the practical moral implications. And so this is in the practical. Romans 14 is towards the end of the book. It's only 16 chapters long. And so he's into the practical section. And he says in Romans 14, "As for the man who is weak in faith, welcome him, but not for disputes over opinions." And so he's contrasting people who are weak in faith with people who are strong in faith. And he says, "One believes that he may eat anything, while the weak man eats only vegetables." And so obviously a strong person, a person who's strong in faith, realizes that food is not going to hurt me, even if it's considered unclean, or even if it's been offered to an idol, it's not going to hurt me because an idol is nothing. But if someone's weaker in faith, they may feel like, ooh, that's pork, that's not clean, I shouldn't eat that, or that chicken was offered to Apollo, I shouldn't eat that chicken. And so I'll just eat only vegetables. So that's the kind of situation that Paul's envisioning. And he says, "Let not him who eats despise him who abstains." So the strong shouldn't look down on the weak. "And let not him who abstains pass judgment on him who eats, for God has welcomed him. So neither party should be despising the other, even though they have a difference of opinion. Who are you to pass judgment on the servant of another? It is before his own master, meaning God, that he stands or falls, and he, the strong one, will be upheld, for his master is able to make him stand. He then says the part that you're discussing, David, one man esteems one day better than another, while another man esteems all days alike. Well, okay, so how does that square with the weak and the strong, which is what we're discussing in this passage? Well, the weak, from what we've seen previously in Romans 14, are those who are afraid of violating Jewish laws that they're not actually bound by. Like, because if you're strong in faith, you realize, I don't need to keep kosher. I can eat whatever I want. It's not a problem. But some people would scruple at that and say, oh, I need to keep this Jewish dietary law, and so I'm just going to eat vegetables so that I don't run a risk of eating the unclean food that's been offered to me, or the food that's been offered to an idol that's been offered to me. I'm just going to stick with vegetables. So it's the weak in this passage who are the ones having scruples. And in context, the one man who esteems one day as better than another is going to be the person who's weak in faith, whereas the one who esteems every day alike is going to be someone who is strong in faith. And the weak in faith in this passage are specifically, given the context in Romans, are going to be scrupling about Jewish holy days. And this is a theme that comes up elsewhere in Paul's epistles. It comes up also, for example, in his letter to the Colossians. In Colossians 2, he talks about how the Old Testament ceremonial laws were a shadow or a set of shadows that pointed forward to Christ. But now that Christ has come, the shadows have passed away and are no longer binding on us. And on that basis, Paul says, therefore, let no man judge you in food or drink. So there's the dietary stuff again, or in regard to a feast or a new moon or a Sabbath. And those were the three kinds of Jewish holy days. You had the annual feasts like Passover and the Day of Atonement. You had the monthly new moons. Every month began with a religious festival when the new moon appeared. And then you had the weekly Sabbaths. And so Paul is saying, don't let anybody judge you in regard to those, you know, be strong in faith. Realize we're not bound by those anymore. And so that's the context for what he's saying here in Romans. He's concerned not about the theory of holy days and saying, oh, we must treat every day as if it's exactly the same. What he's concerned about is helping people to realize that we're not bound by the Jewish holy days, but he also wants to keep peace between Jewish and Gentile Christians. So he goes on to say, even though he's already characterized the strong in faith as esteeming every day alike, so yeah, I don't need to keep the Jewish New Year or whatever, he says, let everyone be fully convinced in his own mind, so he's not trying to disturb your opinion on this, not here. He who observes the day observes it in honor of the Lord. He who eats, eats in honor of the Lord, since he gives thanks to God, while he who abstains in honor of the Lord and gives thanks to God. And he continues on from there. So he's trying to help these Roman Christians live in peace, and he's not trying to, at this point, correct their views about whether or not they need to observe Jewish ceremonial requirements. Now, did Paul, Sykelet, maybe you know the answer to this, did Paul actually recommend religious practices on a particular day of the week?
Yeah, first day of the week.
Yeah, that's right. He talks about that in 1 Corinthians. He says that as part of the charitable activity that he's encouraging, he wants the Corinthians to take up a collection every first day of the week and gather up money so that he can receive it when he comes back to Corinth and then can take it to Jerusalem as an offering to the saints there. So the reason that he is saying do this on the first day of the week is because that's the day Jesus was resurrected. It was the Christian Lord's, the Christian day of worship, the Lord's Day, or the Day of the Lord, to use the term that St. John uses for it in the book of Revelation. He says he saw the vision of Revelation on the Lord's Day, on the first day of the week, which is also why in languages like Spanish, Sunday is called Domingo. Dominus means Lord in Latin, and so Domingo is the Lord's Day. And that apparently was instituted by the apostles. And that would have been an exercise of them binding and loosing. You know, in the Jewish economy, religious economy, the Pharisees, for example, had the ability to proclaim a particular day a day of fasting and say, like, we're going to fast on this day. And then Jesus gave the power to bind and loose to his apostles in Matthew 18. And they similarly said, okay, as Christians, we're going to worship on Sunday, on the first day of the week. And over the course of time, the church added more holy days to the Christian calendar. But St. Paul's not really interested in that. I mean, he himself acknowledges that, okay, yeah, Sunday is a special day. That's when we meet as Christians. And so that's when you should take up a collection. But what he's concerned about here in Romans 14 is you don't need to worry about the Jewish ones. We're not bound by those. And so he says, you know, believe whatever you want about those, but don't judge each other over them. And then later in Colossians, he's more explicit and says, don't let anybody judge you about a feast or a new moon or a Sabbath day, because those were just shadows that pointed forward to Christ. Does that help you out, David?
Yes, thank you very much. I figured it was something along those lines, but I knew, well, rather than me look it up, it was very helpful. Thank you.
Well, David, thank
glad
you.
Glad to be of service.
And I know you're thinking about coming into the Catholic Church, so if you'd like a copy of Jimmy's book, The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness and Where to Find It, just hang on the line and we'll get it to you. I got to take a quick break, however. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
The power of prayer simply means that words have an effect. For example, when a couple says, "I do," it literally changes two people to becoming one in marriage. When you say, "I love you," it changes us and it gives us value. The power of prayer is in the words and in the sentiment, but it's also in the fact that God, who is omnipotent, all-powerful, answers our prayers.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and every line full right now. So back we go to the phones. We'll go to, look at this. Billy, a junior at St. Joseph Academy. I guess, Billy, you weren't able to come in today because it was the seniors who came in. Billy?
Hey, Jimmy.
Oh, all right. Go ahead, Billy. Hey. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
So being juniors, we're all going into college pretty soon. I was wondering, what should we do to prepare for college with relationships? As in, what should we be looking for? When should we start?
Dating?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so dating is a custom that is commonly used in our society. It is not used in all societies. In ancient Israel, for example, people didn't go on dates. Instead, you would have arranged marriages. And You know, you likely would know the person because they lived in the same village as you that you were going to have an arranged marriage with, but you didn't really date them. And there are some advantages to that. I kind of wish our society had this, but it doesn't. What happens in some cultures with dating is you'll have like two or more young people going out to have fun together, but there will be adult chaperones there to make sure that there are no problems that develop as a result of the young people being together unsupervised. In other cultures, you'll have, I'm told this is the case in regard to Mexico, or has been the case in regard to Mexico at least, young people will go out as a group. And so even though there may not be adult chaperones there, the group of kids kind of chaperones itself. In America, it is common to have two young people of some age go out to have fun together without supervision. And that's something that, you know, certainly can happen. It can be legitimate to do that at some point in one's life. When exactly is the appropriate point for that to happen is going to vary, because it's going to depend on the maturity level of the individuals in question. If some person is irresponsible and reckless and just looking to engage in immoral activity, well, then that's someone you should not be going on a date with. On the other hand, if the person is responsible and understands that the purpose of dating is to have fun and get to know each other with an eye to do we want to marry someday maybe, and its purpose is not to engage in immoral behavior, well, that's kind of person that is mature enough to be someone that would be good to date. In terms of when it's appropriate for a specific individual, well, I mean, it's again going to depend on the kind of dating you're talking about. Some parents might say, yeah, I don't have a problem if you want to ask this girl to the dance as long as there are adult chaperones there. On the other hand, when it comes to solo dating, where it's just you and the other person, that's something your parents would be able to advise you better about than I could. Now, if you're in college, the presumption is that you're mature enough for solo dating, but that may or may not be the case in reality. And in that instance, you kind of have to look at yourself and say, well, why am I doing this? How well would I be able to abstain from immoral behavior? And what about the person I'm contemplating dating? You know, are they going to put pressure on me to do something that I shouldn't or not? In terms of what to, I wasn't clear, but based on the way the question was phrased, I think part of it may have been like, what do you look for in a potential spouse? And there are a number of things to look for there. One of them is personal chemistry. Do you genuinely enjoy being with this person? Because if you get married to him, you're going to be with him for a long time. And so do you enjoy being with them? Are they a person of faith? Do they respect you and your faith? Do they want to have kids? What do they plan to do with their life? You know, in terms of a vocation, do they have good earning power? Is their health good? All kinds of things to consider. Obviously, getting married is a very complex and weighty decision. And it's one that, you know, you should, as you contemplate marrying a specific person, it's good to talk with other people about it, you know, and get their advice and their input, because they'll have a different perspective on your prospective spouse and may be able to give you an insight or some insights that may not have occurred to you. In particular, because if you're seriously contemplating marrying someone, you may have already become emotionally attached to this person, and those emotions may interfere with your ability to see certain things about the person that a trusted friend or a parent might be able to spot and say, you know, there's a danger sign here that you should be aware of. So that's some kind of general advice, and I hope that's helpful.
I hope it's helpful as well. Billy, I'm going to keep moving because, as I said, the lines are full, but thank you very much for the call. We'll go to Chicago, Illinois now. David in Chicago, listening on 750 AM. David, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Oh, thank you. Today, of course, is the 105th anniversary of the miracle of the sun at Fatima. And I was listening to Relevant Radio earlier, and I think her name is Barbara Ernster, spoke from the World Apostle of Fatima. And I've heard this before. I'm very familiar with it. I'm sure you are, too. And here's my question. The Blessed Mother told the children that the miracle will be lessened because of the way you have been treated. And I'm just wondering, why in the world was heaven influenced by ignorant socialist men to change their plan?
Okay, so I've studied Fatima quite a bit. I don't recall this particular claim. It may well be true, and I'm just not remembering it, but assuming that it's true, that Mary said the miracle, by which I assume we mean the miracle of the sun that was witnessed by lots of people in October of 1917, that it was diminished in some way because of the way the children had earlier been treated. There was an earlier point where they had been persecuted, and in fact, they even missed their appointment with Mary 1 month because they were being held in custody by the police. Why would heaven choose to diminish the miracle of the sun? Well, this is, I mean, to some extent, a matter of speculation, assuming the children even correctly perceived this message from Mary, because the church acknowledges that the seer's own consciousness can color or even introduce elements into the message they receive. But assuming this message, you know, was genuine and that it came from God or the Virgin Mary, why would it happen? Well, presumably, I mean, she says it's because of the way they were treated. So that's really where we should look for an explanation. And presumably the reason would be that God chooses to give his grace in response to the way people receive his grace. If you're open to his grace, you tend to get more grace. Whereas if you're closed to his grace, you're going to get less grace. And if the Portuguese authorities had embraced the children and treated them well, then that would be a sign that they were open to receiving God's grace, and God might give those Portuguese authorities more grace by giving them a bigger miracle of the sun. On the other hand, now the kids don't need the miracle of the sun because they're already in contact with Mary. The miracle of the sun is not so much for the kids, it's for everybody else. And not everybody else was open to the message of the kids, so not everybody was going to get as much grace, and the miracle would have been diminished. On the other hand, if they'd welcomed the kids in their message, then they would have signaled their openness to God's grace, and presumably they would have gotten more of it in the form of a bigger miracle that more people would witness and be converted by.
David, thank you very much. Appreciate the call and the question. Going to Georgia now. Terry in Georgia, listening to Athens Catholic Radio. Terry, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. I read from places in the Sunday school book that I was trying to teach the children from, and there is a covenant or an agreement or a promise from God that he'll send a Savior. But he's supposed to be saying this to Adam and Eve? I don't know.
Okay, so I know what you're referring to. This is it's actually not Adam and Eve he's talking to at this point, although they are present. This is a passage that's found in Genesis chapter 3, and it's after the fall of man, and God says to the serpent, "I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head," meaning the seed of the woman is going to bruise the serpent's head, "and you shall bruise his heel," meaning the serpent's going to attack the seed of the woman. Now, on the literal level, this is a prophecy of hostility between humans and snakes. Humans and snakes do not get along. Snakes can be poisonous and dangerous, and so humans will step on them and thus bruise or crush their heads. And since snakes are low down on the ground, they tend to attack humans on the feet because that's the part of us they can reach unless they're a special leaping snake. And so on the literal level, this is a prophecy of conflict between humans and snakes. But Scripture works on more than one level. It also, in addition to the literal meaning, has a spiritual meaning. And Christians, in reflecting on this text, have realized that the serpent represents the devil. That's something that's reflected in the book of Revelation. If you look in chapter 12 of Revelation, we see a conflict between a woman in heaven who represents, among other things, the Virgin Mary, her son who represents Christ, her seed, and also the great dragon, which is the serpent or the devil. And so Christians realize that buried in Genesis 3:15 is a prophecy of the future conflict between Christ, the seed of the woman, and the devil. And so Christ crushed the devil's plans by dying for us on the cross, and Christ was struck by the devil in his crucifixion. And so this prophecy is the first announcement of the gospel, is often called the proto-evangelium or first gospel, but it's in the spiritual sense of the text rather than the literal.
Thanks, Terry. Right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
The recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade was a monumental victory for the pro-life movement. But the fight is far from over. With our new booklet, Why We're Pro-Life, we have produced the perfect tool to prepare you to have peaceful and convincing conversations to shed light on the truth about human life from conception to natural death. Catholic Answers is printing millions of copies of this booklet, and we plan simply to give them away. You can help us in two ways. First, by generously supporting this project. 25 cents prints one book. $2,500 prints 10,000, and so on. Second, by helping us distribute the booklet through your parish, your school, or the pro-life ministry you work with. Catholic Answers is going to blanket the country with Why We're Pro-Life, but only if you step up and help us. Thank you so much. For more information, visit whywearepro-life.com.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Sarah on the soundboard. Sarah, thanks for the groovy music. Did you withhold the groovy music from the students from St. Joseph Academy? I see. You weren't intentionally withholding it. We just didn't do it the first hour. It's always nice to hear it. Thank you, Sarah. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. There's two lines open right now, 888-318-7884. Well, that means four lines with calls on them. So off we go back to the phones. Edward in Florida, watching on YouTube. You are next, Edward. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. How are you guys doing today?
Very well, thank you.
Good. Hey, Jimmy, I have a question. You know, with the popularity now of the Latin Mass, I hear more people are considering attending, like, SSPX Masses, just with the restriction and reduction and availability of Latin Mass available in regular parishes. You know, I understand them to be a schismatic movement still. And, there's some confusion out there. Some people think that Pope Francis said it's okay. So my basic question is, are they still in schism? And as a Catholic, a Roman Catholic that is good with the Roman Catholic Church, is it okay to go to a Mass and receive communion there?
Okay, so in regard to the first question, are they in schism? I would say no. because schism carries with it an automatic excommunication. And Pope Benedict rescinded the excommunication that their bishops had back during his reign. And to my mind, that presupposes they're they've withdrawn from schism. They are no longer rejecting in practice the authority of the Roman Pontiff or communion with those who are in communion with the Roman Pontiff, which is the definition of schism. If he had absolved them and they were still in an objective state of schism, they should have just reincurred the penalty. So the fact you can withdraw the penalty presupposes to me that they are no longer in that state. Otherwise, it makes no sense to say, okay, this penalty no longer applies to you if you're still in a state of schism. So I would say that they're not in a state of schism. They're in an irregular state where they are, to a significant degree, celebrating the sacraments apart from the authority of the church. They actually, it's not a full separation, though, or a full irregularity legally, because Pope Francis has granted them the faculties to, for example, hear confessions and do certain do certain things regarding celebrating marriage. And so so it's a partial irregularity legally in terms of what they're doing rather than a full schism. So it's partial disobedience, but not full schism to my mind. In terms of can you go to one of their masses and receive communion? Well, the Code of Canon Law guarantees the right of a Catholic to fulfill his Sunday obligation either on a holy day or the eve of the holy day in any Catholic rite. And since the Missal of 1962 is an approved Catholic rite, regardless of what limitations there may be on it, you've got a right to fulfill your Sunday obligation by attending and receiving communion there if you are in a state to receive communion and you so choose. And this is something that's confirmed by earlier documents from even before the excommunication for schism was lifted. Back during the reign of John Paul II, the Pontifical Commission Ecclesia Dei, which was an organization set up during the reign of John Paul II to deal with these kinds of issues, answered a question about, well, like, can you go to an SSPX mass? And the answer was yes. And they said you could even make a small donation to support the upkeep of the chapel you were attending. Now, having said that, that's all what's possible. Does that mean it's the best thing to do? Well, in some cases, maybe yes. Maybe the local parish is absolutely horrendous, and it's going to damage your faith more than going to an SSPX chapel. On the other hand, there are risks associated with going to an SSPX chapel. It can encourage people to think ill of the Holy Father or the bishops or the Second Vatican Council or things like that. And even if they're not formally in schism, it can encourage a schismatic attitude on the part of the faithful where you just kind of foster a kind of anti-ecclesial anger that will be harmful to you spiritually and that could hypothetically even lead you into formal schism. So it is possible to go to SSPX chapels and attend Mass there and receive communion there or other sacraments, but you want to be careful in doing it because there are risks associated with this as well.
Edward, thank you very, very much. I hope that was helpful to you. As I said, lots of folks on the phone, so I'll just continue on. Kevin in Lexington, Kentucky, watching on YouTube. Kevin, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy and Cy.
Hi, Kevin.
The only arguments for objective morality that I'm familiar with are appeals to intuition and appeals to popularity. I think that the church necessitates her members to believe in objective morality. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm not familiar with any arguments to do so besides intuition and popularity. So does the church necessitate believe in objective morality? And if so, how would a Catholic go about arguing for it? Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Kevin. The church does believe in objective morality, and there are different bases for it that one could argue for it on. there is within the Catholic Church a rich natural law tradition, and the Church argues that God built certain principles into human nature. That's the law that we're concerned about in morality. It's not laws of nature like gravity or electromagnetism. It's the law of human nature, that humans are built in such a way that it is moral and reasonable for them to do certain things but not others. Like, it's reasonable and moral to give medicine to the sick. It is not reasonable or moral to torture small babies for fun. That's out of accord with the proper functioning of human nature. So there's a kind of natural law grounding to this, but in terms of how would you show someone who doesn't believe in objective morality that objective morality is real? And here's where, to my mind, come in the arguments that you mentioned. Humans, unless they're sociopaths, have a profound intuition that it's okay to do some things and not others, and that this isn't dependent on personal choice or things like that. Individuals may have different intuitions about what specific things are moral or immoral, but we all have this intuition that that some things can be done and some things must not be done. And that's an intuition that is so widespread in humanity that it's effectively, I mean, not effectively, it is a human universal, meaning an intuition that is found in all cultures. Now, like I said, there can be individuals who don't have this intuition, like sociopaths, but in every culture in human history all over the world, there has been a belief in right and wrong, in objective morality. And there may be individuals who don't, but this is a profound intuition that is a universal. And anytime there's a universal, that strongly suggests that there is an objective reality to it. And so you're simply living in accord with human nature if you honor that intuition and say, yeah, this is the way things are. It may not be an empirical thing that I can demonstrate with a laboratory test, like I can't measure goodness in a graduated cylinder or, you know, weigh a certain amount of evil in a scale. But the universality of this intuition in human history strongly suggests that it is a non-empirical reality. So that's kind of a general sketch. I'm trying to think, was there something else I meant to mention there? Also, even people who will entertain the idea that objective morality may not exist inevitably fall back into it. It's not possible for a normal person who's not a sociopath to live their life as if there is no morality. Even if they will say things like at various moments, I don't think there's objective morality, they end up acting like there is. And you can think in your own case about, are there things that I would regard as just wrong? Or even if they're not at the moment, do I end up slipping back into the intuition that some things are just wrong? And you could, you know, think about issues that you might find objectionable, like racism or sexism or ageism or torturing babies for fun or Nazis killing Jews or whatever it may be. Do you either consciously have this intuition that, yeah, those things are just wrong, or do you end up slipping back into the assumption that they're wrong, in which case your intuitions are speaking louder than your conscious questioning of this?
Kevin, I very much hope that was helpful to you, but I got to take a break, so I'm going to leave it there. There are a couple lines open, and we may be able to get you on if you dial now, 888-318-7884. If you're on the line, hang on. We'll be right back after this with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio with Matthew Bunsen. Join us every week as we talk with the Register's expert writers and editors about the news you need to know and offer authentic Catholic insights on the important stories that impact your life. Register Radio, every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern and Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern, here on EWTN Global Catholic Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's open forum. 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-31-TRUTH. And up next is Andrew in Anderson, South Carolina, watching on Catholic.com. That's our website, Catholic.com. Andrew, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, could you explain Calvinistic soteriology through a Catholic lens?
Well, so it's going to depend on exactly what you mean by that. So Calvinism is a school in Protestant thought that is famous for having 5 points regarding how they interpret various matters connected with grace and salvation. The 5 points are classically summarized by the formula TULIP, T-U-L-I-P, which is an acronym for total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace, and perseverance of the saints. And there are a range of different Catholic views that have been proposed regarding to those issues over the course of time, and some of them are quite similar to Calvinistic thought. None of them are exactly the same. I mean, for example, nobody prior to Calvin that I've been able to find, certainly no major theological figure, but basically nobody that I've been able to find, advocates what Calvinists call perseverance of the saints, which is the idea that if someone ever enters a state of grace, they will forever remain in that state of grace. Even people who were quite similar to Calvinists, like St. Augustine, they didn't buy that, because it was obvious to everyone you could be a Christian, you could get baptized and enter a state of grace, and then commit mortal sin. However, there are ways of understanding the 5 points in a way that's basically consistent with the Catholic faith, or that's consistent enough that it's possible to construct a kind of Thomistic equivalent of TULIP that even uses the acronym TULIP. And that was a subject that I studied more than 30 years ago when I was in the process of becoming Catholic. I thus wrote a paper called A Thomistic TULIP. It's also called A Tiptoe Through TULIP, and it's online at my website, jimmyakin.com. So if you type in Jimmy Akin and TULIP, it should come up for you, and you can read it for yourself. I should also point out, though, that this is just one perspective, and there are other Catholic perspectives that would depart from Calvinistic soteriology to a greater degree. So even though it's possible to get quite close to Calvinism within a Catholic framework, that there are other possibilities as well that are more distant. And these days, I tend to be more distant from Calvinist soteriology. Does that help, or would you like something more than that, Andrew?
No, that's very helpful, the Thomistic description of Calvinism. I'll look into that. Thank you.
All right.
Okay. By the way, another thing I would recommend is a more recent study I did that is on the concept of election, which is a very key concept in Calvinism, if you're familiar with it. And I concluded that neither in Calvinist nor traditional Catholic theology is the concept of election being used in the biblical sense. If you study the concept of election in the Bible and the early church fathers, it's actually very different. It does not mean chosen by God to be saved on the last day, which is what it means in Calvinism and in Thomism. Instead, it means chosen to have a special relationship with God, like being a Jew meant you were one of the chosen people, but it didn't mean you were going to heaven. And in the same way, being a Christian, being chosen or elect as a Christian, means you're chosen to have a special relationship with God in the Bible, but it doesn't guarantee you're going to heaven. I wrote a short ebook on that that you can find on Amazon called Chosen by God. And so look up Chosen by God by Jimmy Akin, not by R.C. Sproul. And you'll find this inexpensive ebook that you can get and read about the way the Bible, at least, uses the concept of election.
Andrew, thank you. Appreciate that call. I'm going to go now to Ramon in Omaha, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Ramon, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes. Hi, Jimmy. First of all, I would like to say that I'm really impressed with the knowledge that you show. And I always have feeling to give you a call and first of all, tell you that we really appreciate your you've been a convert to the Catholic Church, first of all. But on the other side, I have a really what seems to be a kind of hot question. If you don't feel confident to answer that on the air, then I will understand it. But it's
what's the question?
Catholic deacon. Yeah, I'm a permanent deacon in the Archdiocese. So I am minister a lot to the groups of the church, and I recently was asked this question in regards to the German bishops and their position against against the Pope in this proposal that the society
synodal
has
way
about abortion laws and all this immoral proposals. But my question is that being they bishops of you know elevated hierarchy in the church, they were supposed to stop and to stop the society or the people instead of confronting the Pope and the Holy See. Do you think the question is do you think that or there might be behind those bishops any groups or really important forces that are pushing them in order to confront the Pope? Like can be political groups or financial groups, maybe social groups.
All right, Ramon, thank you.
So the situation is complex, and I'm very hesitant to throw around the term heresy casually. It's clear that the German synodal way involves dissent, which means public opposition to church teaching. So they're definitely dissenting. Whether they cross the line into the canonical crime of heresy is a more complex matter that I don't have the information I would need to answer at this point. In terms of would there be groups financially pressuring the German bishops down this path, probably not, because one of the unique characteristics of Germany is they have a church tax in Germany where unless you like quit the church, a significant, you know, portion of your taxes are directed, not a huge proportion, but a significant portion of your taxes are directed to the church. And so if you're a Catholic, you're paying taxes to support the church, and that happens automatically. And as a result, the German church is one of the wealthiest, maybe the wealthiest church, you know, on a per capita basis of any church in the world, because they just take the money out of your taxes. And so the German bishops are in a financially cushy position. In fact, they're insulated from economic realities in a way that churches that depend on voluntary donations, like the one here in America, are not in. So they're in a very cushy financial position. It's been argued that this is actually bad for them to not be more accountable to their flock, because the bishops, they're getting all this money, they can do whatever they want with it, and they're not really being held accountable. So I wouldn't view it as probable that there's financial pressure being put on the German bishops, at least in any direct way. I think that the pressure is more of a cultural nature, because we're living in a postmodern period, especially in Europe, in a post-Christian period where there are significant ideas that are contrary to the Christian faith that have become very popular in the surrounding culture, especially in the secular culture in Europe. And I think that that's actually the greater cause for why the German bishops are engaging in the kind of dissent that they are apparently promoting through the synodal way.
Ramon, thank you very much for the question. I hope that it was a helpful answer. A few more calls to get to and not much time, so I'm going to keep moving. Sam in North Carolina, watching on YouTube. You are next, Sam. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Si. Hey, Jimmy. My question's about the rite of adelphopoiesis. I know translations of the term call it brother-making.
Yep.
I've also seen some historians call it anachronistically literal as a translation for the term same-sex union. And my question is, how does our modern anthropology square with the way that was maybe understood in times past?
Okay, so the the term adelphopoiesis is based on two Greek roots. The first one is adelphos, which means brother. Adelphe would mean sister. And poieia means to, or poiesis means making. And so adelphopoiesis is making people brothers or making people sisters. And it's a rite that has existed in Christianity for centuries. It's been used in the Catholic Church. It's been used in Eastern Orthodox churches and other Eastern churches. And it's still around today. People still have adelphopoiesis done. If you have someone who is a very special friend and you want to consecrate your friendship, you can go and be made spiritually brothers. And this is kind of like the church equivalent of the blood brother practice. You know, back, I don't know about you, Sam, but when I was a kid, and maybe when Cy was a kid, before bloodborne diseases were commonly known about,
yes,
you would like cut your finger or something and mix your blood together with another friend of yours, and then you would be blood brothers. And because you'd mingled your blood together. And adelphopoiesis is sort of the church equivalent of that, where you can consecrate a special bond of friendship you have in church. Now, a few years ago, there was a Western author named James Boswell. I'm sorry, was it James? It was definitely Boswell. And he was a homosexual gentleman. He wrote a book in which he tried to represent adelphopoiesis as same-sex marriage. And so he would use a non-literal translation of adelphopoiesis as same-sex union and try to represent it as a consecrating a sexual union between two persons of the same sex. However, that's not what it was. That's not what it ever was. That's not what it is now. Like I said, you can still have this done. I remember reading a review of Boswell's book a few years ago by a woman who said, you know, when I read Boswell, it's like, wait, this happened to me. I had an adelphopoiesis with a woman who I was a special friend with. We had our friendship consecrated. I've been through this ceremony. It is not what he's conceptualizing as a same-sex union. And it looks like he took this idea and tried to take a superficially similar rite from history and distort it in order to promote a modern agenda. But fundamentally, adelphopoiesis has nothing to do with sex, meaning the reproductive act. It has to do with consecrating a friendship between two persons. And frankly, I don't know if this has ever been done historically, but you could even have a brother-sister relationship consecrated through adelphopoiesis.
Sam, thanks very much. Mike in Las Vegas, I'm sorry we weren't able to get to you, but we did our very best. Jimmy Akin, thanks very much for two hard-working hours.
My pleasure, Cy Kellett.
Don't forget, tomorrow morning, new episode, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World drops, and it's on the second Cuban Missile Crisis, the secret one you might not know about. Tomorrow, I believe Jason Everett is going to be here, so join us for that, God willing, tomorrow, right here on Catholic Answers Live.